For the week of January 27th, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 179, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. Back in Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And still in New York, I'm Michael Gills. Well, welcome back, Sperling. You're at Sundance. I hope you've recovered.
I have a little bit of a froggy throat or a frog in my throat or a horse throat. Basically, my throat is an animal now.
Okay. But it was a satisfying trip.
It was a satisfying trip. I so far, I think I've clocked it at 32 movies seen. So not bad. I mean,
that's over how many days?
Oh, I think 9.
So over 3 movies a day. Well done.
Yes, over 3 movies a day. And absolutely zero parties attended.
Even better.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, what I love is just as we're going to air, I say that as if somehow we're being beamed out on satellite radio or something, we get this breaking news bulletin about Kevin Tsujihara, who is now named the CEO of Warner Brothers.
Is that how you say his name?
It's how I say his name, but not necessarily how one says his name.
Oh, okay. So in other words, we need to talk about Kevin.
We need to. Yes, we do need to talk. That's probably what Jeff Rabinoff and I think his name is Bruce Rosenblum. Bruce Rosenblum is the head of TV over at Warner Brothers and has done a phenomenal job. Jeff Rabinoff is the head of the studio side, the motion picture side, also having done a phenomenal job. And those two, along with Kevin Tsujihara, it was like a 3-way race to see who Barry Meyer and Jeff Bukes were going to pick as the new CEO of Warner Brothers. And it was like a 2.5-year runoff. And it turns out that Kevin Tsujihara, who was in charge of home video and still is in charge of home video, he won.
And Bruce Rosenblum of Warner Brothers Television said he is, quote unquote, disappointed.
Well, I think, what else can you say? I mean, I don't know if it's...
Think how we feel. I mean, we interviewed for the job. I thought we did a good... I thought, you know, we could have brought Warner Brothers back to that teamwork, the team head that they had before. I felt like we had a good plan for the future for Warner Brothers and where they needed to go. And, you know, I felt like we did a great pitch. It's a little disappointing for us, I think, that we didn't get picked for that as well.
Yeah, I mean, how could you lose by saying, more Batman? We need more Batman. More superheroes.
So we don't know Tsujihara's modus operandi, what he might bring to the job. Now, is he in charge of everything overall? I'm a little confused.
Well, he's going to be the CEO. So, yeah, he's going to be in charge of everything Warner Brothers related.
Well, so that's big breaking news that you let us know about. And we'll know more about that in the days to come. But what are we going to talk about on today's show?
Well, on today's show, get this, we're going to be continuing our long trek toward the Oscars by, well, I guess maybe we can do it quickly. We're going to quickly fill you in on who won big at the Producers Guild and Screen Actors Guild Awards over the weekend. Argo. I'm sorry. As I said, a little frog in my throat there. We'll also wrap up our coverage of the Sundance Film Festival, which, as we mentioned, I'm just getting back from. Then we're going to play a new game called Invest or Don't Invest. And this is a game where Michael is going to tell us which Broadway shows he would invest in if he were that kind of person.
If you mean by that kind of person, a person with money.
Right. I was going to say, by that kind of person, I meant millionaire. At the very end of today's show, we have an email from a listener asking how we record the show each week. So we'll go behind the scenes here at Showbiz Sandbox and tell you how we make the sausage.
Oh, good. I've been wondering that for a while now.
You never want to know how they make sausage, but for one day only, we'll tell you. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
In North America, it was a down weekend at the box office for the first time in the new year. A lot of disappointing movies opened up, namely Hansel and Gretel. But worldwide, it's hard to get a beat on week to week and month to month because nobody else gathers the information that we do. But the number one movie around the world is Quentin Tarantino's Django Unchained. It made another $48 million and it's at $258 million worldwide and counting.
I mean, that is just so much money for a Quentin Tarantino movie. That's pretty
well,
remarkable.
Not when it costs $120 million to make.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, why do you think this movie is doing so well?
Well, the last one, Inglourious Basterds, was one of his highest grossing of all time worldwide. It really, I think, brought him to a new level of maturity. It was a film that didn't just appeal to film geeks. It was a classic war movie. It introduced a big new European star in Christoph Waltz. And I think he's just he's not shocking or doing quirky little genre stuff just for their own sake. He's telling more of an emotional story. I mean, I think the characters are richer. I just think he's reached a new level of filmmaking success.
Okay, so he's perfected his craft a bit, and audiences have taken notice.
Absolutely. And, okay, of course, he's been a big name for years, and he's ready to capitalize on that. And when he was able to deliver, people were ready. At number two around the world is the new number one film in North America. That's Hansel and Gretel, The Witch Hunters. It grossed $44 million worldwide. It's at $55 million so far and counting because it opened up overseas last week. 66% of ticket sales in North America were for the 3D version. So that's a very strong launch, though it grossed only $19 million, which was quite a disappointment. So you have to wonder, is one reason the grosses are so low the fact that people felt they didn't want to pay 3D at all? We've been seeing a lower percentage for 3D. Now we could be seeing a new trend. The movie sells 70% of its tickets in 3D, but it only sells 10 tickets.
It could also be the fact that, like, college kids are going back to school. It's a new year. People have just seen four movies over the holidays.
The movie opened much lower than tracking and expectations.
Okay.
They know when they were opening it. They you can open a movie big any time of the year. I think it's just that it's a bad movie and everybody knew it. And I'm just saying that the reason 3D sales were sort of a solid percentage of the overall ticket sales because so few people went in the first place.
Okay.
So I don't think that that's an actual uptick or some indication that suddenly people are embracing 3D again. It's a bad movie, but the few people that went felt like they should see it in 3D. At number three around the world is Skyfall, the James Bond film. It opened it up in China, along with some minutes snipped out of the film, thanks to Chinese censors. But it's huge now, at $35 million worldwide. Another big weekend for the film in its last market around the world. It's now over $1 billion, of course, worldwide. It's the sixth biggest international hit of all time, the eighth biggest hit of all time worldwide. So just one more big market for Skyfall. At number four around the world is Life of Pi, Ang Lee's Oscar hopeful. It grossed another $20 million. It's at $525 million and counting. At number five is Les Miserables, the musical, which grossed $18 million worldwide. It passed the $300 million mark, which makes it, I think, the third or fourth highest grossing musical of all time without adjusting for inflation. At number six and seven, two movies tied at $14 million. Lincoln, which is now at $185 million. And Mama, the Jessica Chastain horror film, which is now at $50 million. It's essentially open in North America.
You know, what's remarkable to me is, you know, you think we've been hearing so much about Lincoln. It seems like we've been hearing about this movie for about 5 months. We actually have been hearing about it for 5 months, but it's only made $185 million worldwide.
That's because it's just opening up overseas. It only started open up this month.
I know. But you would think
it's one of his biggest hits of all time as a drama. It's one of his best grossing films of all time. Given the budget, it's a huge success already. And now it's opening up overseas time to the Oscar season. It's
and by his, you don't mean Lincoln, you mean Steven Spielberg.
Yes.
Okay, just checking.
Yeah, but, not every movie opens up day and date around the world. Surely.
I know.
Well, it's not surprising at all that it's made $185 million to date because it hasn't opened up in most of the world. It's just starting to. At number eight is another Jessica Chastain film, Zero Dark Thirty, that made another $13 million. It's at $77 million and counting. At number nine and 10, two movies tied at $11 million. Silver Linings Playbook has started to open strongly around the globe. That made $11 million. It's at $83 million and counting. And Gangster Squad, which is not doing much better overseas than it has been in the U.S., it made $11 million. It's at $68 million and counting, but it's falling hard. At number 11 is The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey. Another $10 million as it claws its way to the $1 billion mark. It's at $940 million, so we'll have to wait and see if it makes it.
I don't think it's going to. I don't think it's got another $60 million in it.
Well, it's slowing down, but if I knew specifically if there were any big markets left for it, I might have a better judge. Has it opened in China, for example?
No, that's true. I don't know.
See, you got to know what markets it's playing in, and we really can't track that unless they specifically tell us. It's hard for us to know what markets these films have or have not opened in yet. It'd be great if that information was readily available, but it's not, at least not to us. And number 12 is The Impossible, the tsunami film. That made $9 million. It's at $130 million worldwide. And number 13, a North American debut, it's Jason Statham's new actioner film, Parker. It grossed a tepid $7 million. That's for a film that cost $35 million to make. Number 14 is Wreck-It Ralph, the animated film. It's at $368 million worldwide. And then three movies tied at $5 million. The Last Stand, the Arnold Schwarzenegger film, which is collapsing overseas just like it is in North America. Flight, the Denzel Washington film, which is starting to open up overseas, hopefully timed to him receiving an Oscar nomination for Best Actor. And then the real curiosity of the year, let's come back to it in a minute. It's called Movie 43. It grossed $5 million in its opening weekend, even though it stars some of the biggest names in Hollywood. And right below them are three more movies tied at $4 million. Broken City, the Mark Wahlberg, Russell Crowe film. Jack Reacher, the Tom Cruise movie, which is running out of steam and looks like it will not get to the magic number it needs to trigger a sequel. And Ted, which is still churning away overseas. But movie 43, what the heck is this movie?
I have no idea. I mean, all of a sudden, we started to see ads for it out of nowhere. And I'm like, wait a second, there's Kate Winslet. Oh, and Halle Berry. And wait, is that Hugh Jackman? It is Hugh Jackman. And that's Naomi Watts and Dennis Quaid.
I guess it was a well-intentioned film. It's a collection of shorts, sort of like the spoof film's Kentucky Fried Movie back in the 70s. Peter Farrelly oversaw the whole project. And it's a bunch of shorts made by different directors with big-name stars doing quickie little, you know, three-day shoots, I imagine. And it's all tied together with some stupid story about Dennis Quaid pitching a movie to a studio exec and holding a gun to him while he keeps pitching movies. And apparently one short is less funny than the next. It's all, how you could make 10 or 12 shorts with all these talented people and every single one is horrible, but they managed to do it. It came out without any reviews. It just came into the theater. It's just a bizarro footnote, I think, in Hollywood history.
Yeah, I don't know how they got this film made.
Well, like, you know, he just said, hey, let's do this. It's like 3 days for Kate Winslet to shoot a short, you know. Let's do it. It's fun. Hey, everybody does it for a lark, does it for scale. It's just a few days. It's fun. Hey, maybe it'll be funny. Who knows? And of course, it turned out not to be. But a couple interesting things. In limited release, Dustin Hoffman's directorial debut, Quartet, is doing quite well. It had the second highest per screen average of any film in theaters. It's on 163 screens now, so it opened up a little more broadly. The only film that has a better per screen average is the French film Amour, which is only on 64 screens. So those limited release movies are doing quite well. And frankly, if you're a movie theater owner, you were going to decide, should I book Hansel and Gretel or should I book Quartet, this movie starring Maggie Smith, a woman in her 70s or 80s, I don't know. The answer is you should have booked Quartet because that movie's making more money for you per screen.
Well, yeah, and if you're a theater owner and you know that families live around you, there's not much for you to do.
Oh, right, exactly. This week was dominated by R-rated films. There's virtually no family-friendly films in the theaters at all except for The Hobbit and Parental Guidance, which have been out for weeks, if not months. So there's literally nothing to take your kids to.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a good time for Disney to release, I don't know, well, The Little Mermaid in 3D.
Exactly. Bad timing on the studio's part. Bad programming. They really should have thought of a family film for January.
That's true. But, you know, it is January, which means everybody's turned their attention towards the awards season, not only for music, the Grammys are on February 10th, but also for movies. And over the weekend, we had the Screen Actors Guild Awards and the Producers Guild Awards. And the big winner there, as I coughed up earlier, was Argo.
That's right, Ben Affleck's film. He's not even nominated for Best Director at the Academy Awards, and his movie has now won three of the biggest awards out there, the Golden Globes, and then two awards, SAG and PGA, which are actually voted on in part by people who vote for the Oscars. There are a lot more people in SAG than vote in the Oscar campaign, and the PGA, I think, represent like 5%, I think, of Oscar voters. Nonetheless, you know, it's a good sign of momentum for Argo. Does that mean we should ignore everything we've thought all season long? You know, I think I always get tossed off by these weird quirks. Oh, no, Argo won this. It didn't win that. It's doing this. It's doing that. I'm still going to stick with Lincoln.
Really? You still? Okay, so
I'm just saying this is all noise. It's all confusion. But I do love the conspiracy theory about why Ben Affleck did not get a Best Director nod from the Oscars. And the reason is that Sidney Pollack died.
Wait, what? Wait, are you sure that you're... Are you serious?
Anthony Lumet, he died too. That's why Ben Affleck didn't get a nomination. The argument is that the older directors, the ones who sort of love the studio system, or at least love the major studios and the mainstream fare that the studios represent, have been dying off. We had a number of notable people die, and there aren't that many people in the Academy. So Sidney Pollack died, Sidney Lumet, and named a couple other people. When those people die, they're being replaced by younger people like the Dardenne brothers from France and other indie people, people who love independent film more. And so the argument is that the Directors Guild is getting a little younger and reflecting the taste of people who really love independent cinema. Therefore, Beasts of the Southern Wild gets a Best Picture and Director nomination, but Argo gets shut out in the Best Director Awards. That's the theory.
That's your theory, or is that somebody else?
My theory. That's a theory that's out there online trying to figure out why he got snubbed, but why Argo could still be doing well for Best Picture. They're now suggesting that the directing branch of the Academy doesn't reflect the overall sensibility of the Oscar voters.
Well, I think there's only like 375 to 400 directors that are in that branch that select the best director. And you're right. Once the Academy opens up for to pick winners, so they've already nominated their nominees in different categories. I think 25 different categories. Once it opens up to the entire 6,000 some odd members in the Academy, then you're right. The Screen Actors Guild or the Actors Branch really takes over, and they can really. That's why everybody looks at SAG so much to see who wins there, because normally who wins at SAG, there's a pretty good shot they're going to win the Academy Award as well.
Well, that's, I mean, you know, there's counter examples left and right. Yeah, you know,
I'm sure.
They're like,
yeah.
Yes, in the last 4 years they've done well, but in the 8 years before that they did poorly. You know, there's no guarantee whatsoever, and you can find them online in the articles we linked to from the Hollywood Reporter. Only one film in the last 80 years has won Best Picture without being nominated for Best Director, and that's Driving Miss Daisy, a movie that should not have won Best Picture. But, you know, it's a good indicator. Whatever all the tea leaves and all the excuses and all the changing trends, in the end, ultimately, the Oscars usually makes the boring choice, and that would be Lincoln.
Well, certainly nominating Ben Zeitlin for Director and Beasts of the Southern Wild for Best Picture, you know, this was a film that was at Sundance last year.
And it was the big winner there.
It was the big winner, and everybody, you know, was the talk of the festival. This year, at this year's Sundance Film Festival, there really weren't any big, well, I mean, there were big winners, sure, but there was nothing that blew everybody away. There was no Beast of the Southern Wild where you kind of walked out of the theater and said, oh my goodness, that Blue Valentine was fantastic, or Winter's Bone was amazing, you've got to go see it. There was nothing, I mean, even Fruitvale, which won, I guess it won the audience award.
And the grand jury prize.
For the dramatic competition. You know, I saw it, I thought it was interesting, it was above average, but I didn't think it was fantastic, great, you have to go out and race to see it.
So it wouldn't be on your best of the year list come 2014 when you're looking at the best movies of this year? You
probably
think it's
not
unlikely?
Well,
did you
unlikely.
See any movies that might make that list? One,
ooh.
Two, three. When I go to Cannes, I usually see at least two or three movies that make my best of the year list.
Maybe Concussion, which I know would be, a lot of people would say, how, why in the world would he pick Concussion? Maybe. There were some films like The Summit, which I did not get to see. This is a documentary about...
Can't name movies you haven't seen.
Climbing K2. True. You're right.
So far, no. No locks.
No locks. Definitely no locks. No.
Well, from the outside, it looked like the reviews this year were a lot stronger and there were a lot more commercial films. Putting that in quotes, commercial for an independent cinema. But there were more commercially inclined films, more audience-friendly films, and the reviews seemed pretty strong. So the best winner overall was Fruitvale, and the best winner in documentary was Blood Brother, a documentary about a man helping HIV-positive kids in India, which sounds awfully inspiring. And there were a lot of female directors. 8 out of the 16 films that were in competition at Sundance were directed by women, so that's certainly a notable trend that was talked about, I think, in LA Weekly and the New York Daily News. But I think the biggest news was the big price tags on a lot of movies.
Yes, and you know, just not to stop us from moving on to that topic, one of the winners for the Waldo, well, she's the only winner for the Waldo Salt Screenwriting Award was Lake Bell, one of those women you're talking about, and she directed a film called In a World. And it's about voiceovers, about trailer voiceovers.
Did you like it?
I thought it was great, actually. It was one of the better films up there. And she's basically, I think she actually wrote it and stars in it and directs it. And it's she plays the daughter of a world-renowned voiceover artist. And they're trying
Honey, I want you to pick up your room.
Right, exactly. And they're trying to bring back in the industry the catchphrase, in a world. You know, that.
Oh, yeah. In a world where two men are fighting for one woman.
Right, exactly. So, and the question is, could they possibly give it to a woman? It's a funny film.
Well, all right. Well, I look forward to checking that out.
But you were talking about all these films that I guess were picked up for what, a couple dimes and a nickel?
Right. There were a lot of big price tags after several years of sort of recession-wary buyers where they were not spending a lot of money for the films at Sundance, and which is why, since most movies are not going to make more than $1 million or $2 at best, you know, you're very lucky if you get something like The Beast of the Southern Wild, which grosses more than $10 million. That's a very unusual situation. But this year, there were a lot of big bets placed. One of the biggest was for Don John's Addiction. That's the Joseph Gordon-Levitt film. It was sold for $4 million, which is not a record. But the people who bought it, Relativity, guarantee they would spend $25 million on print and advertising, which is a huge outlay to turn that movie into a big hit. This is $29 million they're wagering just for domestic rights only. So that means the film, I think, has to make at least $60 million at the box office just to break even.
Well, a couple points here. One, I think that, first of all, they can... I wouldn't be shocked if this movie made $60 million. It stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt. It stars Scarlett Johansson. It stars Tony Danza in what could be an award-winning performance if people go see this movie. He's very good in it. And which you would not... I mean, those words coming out of my mouth, Tony Danza, award, you know, they should not be in the same sentence.
But, and he can sing and dance.
And he can... Well, that's true, but he did not sing and dance in this movie. It's a movie about a young man, played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
We talked about it. He has a sex addiction. He loves porn, and then he meets a real-life porn babe in Scarlett Johansson. Can he learn how to have a real relationship rather than just keep staying addicted to the naughty videos online?
Right. Well, she's not a porn babe, but, you know, somebody who is.
No, she does. She doesn't work in the porn industry, but she's babelicious.
Babelicious, yes, I guess. And it's very funny. I think that part of this $25 million is going to be in-kind services, meaning that, yes, there will be some amount of money that they had to spend to get the prints out there. So part of that $25 million, they would have had to have spent anyway, even if they spent $4 million to buy it. And part of it will be in make goods and, you know, it's not all going to be cash. Let's put it that way.
All right. Of all the films Joseph Gordon-Levitt has starred in, only one has grossed more than $60 million, and that is Looper.
What about the Batman? Oh, okay.
He didn't star in that. He didn't star in Lincoln or Batman or Inception or G.I. Joe, The Rise of Cobra. His other big film is, you know, 500 Days of Summer. That made $32 million. 50-50, $35 million. And then a lot of movies like Premium Rush, the bicycle movie, awful film, $20 million. You know, he's got $7 million, $10 million, $4 million, $2 million. A lot of movies making less than $60 million. Nothing he has starred in except for Looper has hit that number. Well, so there's no reason to think because Joseph Gordon-Levitt stars in it, you're going to make $60 million. I love the guy. I think he's terrifically talented. But this is an independent film. It's a hard R. It's going to be lucky to get an R rating. They're going to have to mess with the editing to get there. And it's, you know, it's not a broad appeal movie.
No, and this may be one of those movies. I call it the Happy Texas moment. Happy Texas was a film that was purchased for, I think, $10 million back in 1998, 99.
And made $4.75 at the box office.
I think I saw it at the box office. Yeah, I mean, it made no money at all. It was a huge loss. And from that point on, and even a little bit before that, people were saying, my goodness, what do people think up there in Park City, Utah, when they go to maybe it's the altitude, maybe it's the cold weather, you know, it's a ski town, but they spend ridiculous amounts of money and get caught up in these bidding wars for films that could never make that kind of money.
Another example, perhaps a more commercial one, is The Way, Way Back, a coming-of-age film, which has some big names in supporting roles, like Allison Janney and Steve Carell and Sam Rockwell. Steve Carell may be the one that's an actual box office draw to a degree, but it stars an unknown kid named Robert Capron and really Sam Rockwell. And it's about a 14-year-old kid's coming of age. It was $10 million. That's what Fox Searchlight paid for this movie.
Yes, but having said that, it is very good. It does star name talent, and it was...
Very commercial?
Yes, it is very commercial, and it does star all the, you know, it has A-list talent in it, as you mentioned, yes.
But not box office draws.
But not, I mean, certainly maybe not box office draws in their own right. Maybe Steve Carell, as you said. Allison Janney puts in she steals the entire movie. Her character is fantastic. I would not be surprised, even with the small amount of screen time she has, if people start talking about her for an award or two at the end of next or at the end of this year. But more to the point, it was written by Jim Rash and I think his name is Nat Faxon, the screenwriting team behind The Descendants.
That's the Oscar film that George Clooney starred in about a family in Hawaii battling over their estate.
That's right. And they won an Academy Award for it.
That's right, but that doesn't mean they're going to make money. But so that seems like a smart commercial bet. There were also a lot of documentaries that went for big dollars. Last year, only one documentary film sold for $1 million or more. This year, four documentaries sold for $1 million. And to put that in perspective, throughout the entire history of cinema, only 74 films have grossed more than $2 million at the box office. I mean, $1 million is a lot of money to spend on a documentary. So what's going on, Sperling? What's your explanation?
By the way, before everybody writes in, Rob Corddry also stars in Way, Way Back. Maya Rudolph stars in
it. No, but they're not
Collette.
Stars.
None of these people are stars.
Right. The star is Robert Capron and Sam Rockwell. So let's put that in perspective, just because someone appears in a scene. And again, nobody has ever paid a dime to go see Rob Corddry in a film, for God's sake.
No, I'm just, you know.
Nobody. The TV names that trigger a bell doesn't mean you're going to plug down $9 to go see the movie at the box office.
That's true.
Yeah, so this is not a star. This isn't George Clooney and Tom Cruise in secondary roles. It's Rob Corddry. So don't tell me that suddenly this movie is a commercial blockbuster. What's going on? Why are these prices? Why have they gone through the roof this year?
Well, I think a couple of reasons. I think you're right. I think in 2010 you couldn't sell your movie. Basically, distributors were saying, "How about you give me $50,000 and I'll distribute your movie, and any money I get back, I will cheat you out of."
So that was the recession.
They basically wanted to take your movie, and you were thankful that they were willing to distribute it. Now, I think that, you know, effectively the recession is over a bit. You've got a little bit more of an independent. First of all, you have Beasts of the Southern Wild, so there's some, you know, an example.
Well, that's stupid though, just because one movie has been hit.
I understand that. I'm not saying it's right, but you have a few more independent.
And they didn't overpay for Beasts of the Southern Wild.
No, they did not. And since the recession, a few additional independent players have come onto the scene, and a few additional independent players have come onto the scene and are doing well, like Magnolia Pictures. And
well, there's always new players, but that makes the most sense to me. The idea is you've got a shingle, you've got a company, you've got employees on the payroll, and you need to distribute movies because that's what you do. So you can't just sit around for 6 months doing nothing. So it's better to have everybody working on something than sitting in their office.
That's right. Now, here's the other thing that I think a lot of people are missing. Look at the Sundance Channel. Look at IFC. Look at AMC. All of these networks, these cable networks, and there are more and more of them every time you turn around, they need content. And they're all beginning to do scripted programming. So they need content. They need something to put commercials into.
So you're saying movies are more valuable than ever? There's more money to be made on television and DVD and all that?
And Netflix and Hulu, yes, there is. More people are paying. Now, mind you, they're not making $30 million on DVD anymore, but they might make $3 or $4 million on DVD and another $3 or $4 million on Netflix and another $3 or $4 million on cable. So you start putting that all together, and all of a sudden you can pay $5 million for a film, make $3 million in theatrical, and you still have room to actually make a profit. And I think that's what's going on here. Is that
another cash cow for people who own movies that hasn't been around before. The DVD is failing, but other ones are popping in to take its place.
Right. And they're not as lucrative, but you put all of that money together and you can start making, you know, $4, $5, $6, $7 million offers.
Right. There was that's a huge amount for a Sundance film. But there was a little tidbit in a Variety article about French films that mentioned, by the by, that video on demand via the internet. That's as opposed to cable video on demand, where you go to Time Warner Cable and say, I want to watch the new Steve Carell film. When you go to video on demand via the internet, like Netflix and iTunes and Vudu, that market in North America doubled last year from about $1.6 billion to $2.3 billion. So a lot more people are making a lot more money, and there's no reason to think it won't continue to grow than they were even just a year ago.
Yeah, I like the one thing that this, I guess, Submarine Entertainment's Josh Braun said. He said, I think there is a realization that when you hit Monday and your flight is probably going to take off Wednesday morning, and if you can't leave the festival without a film, now is the time to make a deal. And he's absolutely right. That is exactly what it's like up there. You know you're leaving Wednesday, maybe Thursday, and if you're at Tuesday and you're 6, 7 days into this festival and you don't have a film, and that was the reason you were sent to Sundance, you better pick something up. And that's
that doesn't make sense to me. It's like you shouldn't pick something up. You should only pick something up if you think it makes financial sense.
No, I agree with what you just said, but the mindset of some of these executives may not be the same. I don't know why.
Then they're idiots.
I think some of these docs are going for big money because they do have a long life. 20 Feet from Stardom. That's a film that will probably do quite well theatrically and on television. Blackfish, CNN. Needs content, so they're willing to pay for it. Magnolia Pictures and CNN picked that up. The Summit, again, the K2 mountain climbing movie. Sundance Selects picked it up. That'll do well. And Pussy Riot, A Punk Prayer was one of the big documentary hits of the festival. HBO Films picked it up for more than $1 million. I can see why.
Do we have any idea what Beast of the Southern Wild went for? I can't remember what it sold for.
I think it
for.
Was $4 million.
So that's a serious bet.
Yes.
It cost, I think, $1.8 million to make.
Yes.
So that was a gamble. That was a serious gamble, but it paid off very well. So you had a great time at Sundance. We have a list of about 32 films that you saw. Those are all the ones you can remember. People can look through them and see which ones you caught. You caught a lot of the big ones. So that's exciting to see. But did you catch The Party, Sperling? And everybody knows what I mean when I say The Party.
Well, yes. Let me guess what you mean. You mean the party of the Republicans. There are some Democrats. You mean the political party.
No, I mean the bawdy CAA party that shocked the entire Sundance world.
Oh, yes. Okay. So you meant the party. Yes. This was, no matter what you were doing at Sundance, it did not matter. You told somebody you were at Sundance. You did an interview, a radio interview, a television interview, a newspaper. They wanted to know one thing. They all asked the same question. Hey, did you go to that CAA party? That was the question they asked.
Because what happened there?
This was, you know, every year, all the agencies go up there. They're looking for new, fresh, young talent, whether it be a writer, a director, or an actor or actress that they can pick up. I remember years when people went up there and they found this little funny film about swingers and picked up.
Yes, but what, the party. Tell us about the party.
I didn't go to the party, but every year these agencies throw parties for their clients and potential clients. And I guess at this party, there was a bunch of lewd, erotic dancers outfitted with different kinds of sex toys, and there was simulated sex acts
going
on.
Hey, there goes
on.
Our family rating. Be careful.
Okay, well, so maybe I should stop there. But the creative
artist... Let's not mention the man in the rabbit suit.
Yes, who was doing something to Alice in Wonderland. Creative artist agency, normally a very upstanding, and they really kind of hone their image. They control their image quite well. And
they're upstanding?
Well, you know what I mean.
They have their manly man, you know, parties and bachelor getaways where they go, you know, whitewater rafting because they're, you know, I figured they were just as hard partying guys like everybody else in Hollywood.
I've got a frog in my throat.
They're not known for being puritanical.
No. But what I mean by that is they are kind of the...
they're the big player, but that doesn't mean that they're not going to be, you know, outrageous.
No, and they're blue chip, I guess, is the what I was...
You wouldn't
blue chip
expect
agents.
Time Warner to throw a party like this, but CAA did. Did they apologize? Were they embarrassed?
They were. They said that they regretted the entertainment at the party. It went a little bit overboard, and it was not necessarily what they expected. They had hired...
When we hired, you know, strippers and exotic dancers, we had no idea there would be strippers and exotic dancers.
Right. Well, and this was a Sundance. And look at the title of our last episode. I think it was Sex Sells at Sundance. I mean, there were at least three or four movies that dealt with pornography directly. You mentioned one, Don John's Addictions. There was one about a porn star, Lovelace, that seemed to get fairly decent reviews, and starred Amanda Seyfried. And, you know, Interior Leather Bar was another one James Franco directed. So it was kind of a raunchy Sundance to begin with, content-wise. This was
How sad that you go to Sundance and all people want to talk about is a party where some people goofed around.
Yeah, and that I didn't even go to.
Well,
I bet you there were like maybe 500 people at this party, and there's 50,000 people talking about it.
Well, then maybe that's a success.
Right. Now, speaking of successes, I mean, it's really hard to make a film, get it into Sundance, get it picked up by a distributor, and for it to be a success. So that lightning in a bottle, Beast of the Southern Wild thing, it doesn't happen all the time. It may be even harder to do that on Broadway.
I don't know. I think it's easier to pick potential success stories on Broadway. I think I wouldn't back a slate of movies. I think that would be, you know, with my own money, you'd just be a fool to do that. I'd be happy to help a studio pick what movies they should make, and I bet I would do a pretty good job. I think you and I would do just as well as any other studio exec. But on Broadway, somehow, I have always felt like it was easier to pick winners. And I was reminded of this recently when I met somebody who was friends with a big publishing bigwig, and she mentioned that he had invested in Memphis, which was the Tony winner for Best Musical a few years ago. And it ran for like 2 years, had a pretty good, quite a good run. And she said how he had made a ton of money on the show thanks to The Road and regional productions and all stuff like that, that she made a mint off investing in that show. And I wasn't sure if I would have invested in Memphis based on the people in it. But I've always felt like, hey, if you give me like three or four shots, I'm going to pick a winner. And if I pick one winner, that can set you up for years. You know, you're going to be rich, rich, rich. If you pick a really big winner on Broadway, you know, you can make a bundle.
Well, then I think we should play our new game, Invest or Don't Invest. And how is this going to go, Michael? Why don't you tell us how this works?
Well, we've got a list of the upcoming shows that are coming to Broadway in 2013, mainly musicals, but a few plays, because musicals are where the money's at. And we'll briefly describe them to you, what they are, just the name. And then, Sperling, you can guess whether you think I would invest in it, and then I'll tell you my answer.
Okay. Oh, okay.
I was at a play sitting next to a guy who was talking to his guest, and he told her, oh, I invested in Kinky Boots, this new musical from Cyndi Lauper and Harvey Fierstein. And he said, oh, I invested in it, to which I wanted to say, why?
Exactly.
And I think you have to invest at least $100,000. I think that's like the minimum to play as far as the Broadway world is concerned. They'd obviously like you to invest more, but that seems to be the minimum, you know, to play the game, to sit down at the table. You got to at least start with $100,000.
Hey, man, I watch Smash. I know what's going on here. I know what time it is.
Okay, so here we go.
All right. Now, by the way, it's okay that we moved on to this game, right? I know you wanted to talk about some other Sundance films.
No, I'm ready.
Okay. All right. So I'm just giving you a little bit more time to warm up.
Okay.
But all right. So Cinderella. Okay. This is a show. It's opening in March. It stars Laura Osnes and Santino Fontana. The book is by Douglas Carter Bean. The songs are by these newcomers, Rodgers and Hammerstein.
That is the worst joke. these new crazy kids. Yeah, it's based on their TV special, which was a blockbuster starring Julie Andrews back in the day. It's never been on Broadway. The Tony Awards have finally ruled on it. They said this will not be considered a new musical. It will be considered a revival, even though technically it's never played on Broadway. But that's certainly the right decision. It's been around for 60 years.
Wait. I haven't said whether you would invest in it. And I'm going to go with a no.
Oh, no, I would invest. Absolutely. It's got a great score. And, you know, with a musical, that is step number one. It's a great score. It's a great property. I mean, it's a public domain property, Cinderella. But it's, a beloved fairy tale. It has great music by two of the greatest composers of all time. It has a smart book by Douglas Carter Bean, who's done some smart Broadway shows. And as always, for all these shows, we're looking at them blind. We haven't really heard songs in most cases. So we're really talking about, would we invest just sight unseen based on the talent involved in the property you're dealing with? Anything can change once you sit down and listen to the score. It could be disastrous. It could be brilliant. In this case, it's a score that we all know already, or at least Broadway musical fans know. Women are 60% of the Broadway audience. The two young stars in it are not household names, but they are major rising talent on Broadway. They're both very talented. So what I love about it is you've got really talented Broadway actors, but the show is not linked to them, which means when Laura Osnes steps away a year into the run, if you're lucky enough to go that far, the show's not going to collapse financially because she's not in it anymore. People will want to see her if it gets good reviews, but you can put someone new in that. It's not the same as losing, say, Hugh Jackman or Nathan Lane. I would absolutely invest in this show.
Okay. Now, we have about 2012.
I'll be going a lot quicker.
Okay. Because otherwise...
I'm just trying to explain how this is working.
All right. The next production, I'll call it, since that's what it is Anne, which is...
This is a one-woman show starring Holland Taylor of Two and a Half Men. She wrote and she stars in it. It's about politician Anne Richards of Texas, the woman who was a famous fixture in her home state and brushed onto the national stage when she sort of ripped George Bush a new one quite entertainingly, where she said things like he was born with a silver spoon in his mouth.
Right. and by new one, we should explain that you mean that you should have stopped me by now.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's what this one woman show is about. And it opens at Lincoln Center.
Right. And so I would go with, yes, you would invest in this.
And I would say, sadly, no.
What?
Specifically because it's at Lincoln Center. It's playing at a Broadway house. And it's a kind of a large space. A lot of musicals are done there. And this is a one woman show. It just feels like a cavernous space in which to see the show. It's the wrong theater. So I like Holland Taylor. I'm interested to see the show. It sounds like it could be entertaining, and it could have a long life in, you know, regional productions and touring and all that. But she also has to get back to Two and a Half Men, so there's probably a limit to how long she can run in it. So with all that taken into mind, and especially the fact that it's in such a large Broadway house, I would not invest in it.
Okay.
None of this has to do whether it'll be good or not, of course. That's a separate issue. We're just saying, do I think it'll be a commercial hit?
Now, Hands on a Hard Body is based on a documentary, which I think screened at Sundance. It stars Keith Carradine and Hunter Foster. The book is by Doug Wright with songs by Trey Anastasio. I can never pronounce his name. He's of Fish, of course. And Amanda Green, the daughter of Adolph Green, the famous songwriter.
And you know this documentary, obviously.
Yes, I do.
It's one you had a long life with.
Yes, it is.
It's about people who are in part of the contest where you got to keep your hand on a car. And if you keep it on, if you're the last one to be touching the car, you win it.
That's correct. So would you invest in this? I would say, no, you would not.
You are right. Why did you think I wouldn't?
Because I think previously on this very show, you said, oh, what a stupid idea.
Right. And Trey Anastasio of Fish, you may love Fish, but that is not a recipe for a good Broadway score. You know, he's just, his melodies are long, drawn out, and jam-like. So I have no confidence that he is has a gift for Broadway songs that create characters and move the plot along. Again, if you actually hear the score and go, oh my God, it's brilliant. You know, it's a crazy, nutty idea. It sounds like a train wreck. You never know, creatively. But commercially, I would not invest in it.
Now, this next one, I'm going to say outright you're going to invest in it. It's Lucky Guy. It opens in April. It stars Tom Hanks and Peter Scolari in a Nora Ephron play about a hard-nosed New York City newspaper columnist, and it's going to be directed by George C. Wolfe. Again, I'm going to say you're going to invest.
Blue nose. Blue chip people all around, and I would not invest.
Whoa. Okay, so then moving on
It's Tom Hanks, and he's not going to commit to 2 years in the show. And the second he leaves, you might find another big celebrity to go into it, but it's a very dangerous proposition. You probably only got 6 months or so. It feels more like stunt casting, and it's a play. So it might be great creatively, but I would not invest in it.
What about Matilda, which also opens in April? It's a UK import directed by Matthew Warchus. I don't know how to pronounce his name. It's based on the book by Roald Dahl. I'm going to go with no, you're not going to invest.
No, absolutely. This is a slam dunk. They don't want me to invest because it's already a massive hit in the UK. It won all the big awards over there. The Olivier is the biggest one. And it's the biggest UK musical since Billy Elliot. So this is a clear hit. It's going to win the Tony for Best Musical when it opens here this spring. This is as close to a safe bet. You know, if you're going to bet on Daniel Day-Lewis winning the Oscar, you can bet on Matilda being a big commercial hit.
Kinky Boots also opens in April. And it's based on an indie British film about a shoe company going bankrupt that is revitalized by ideas from a drag queen. The songs are by Cyndi Lauper.
Bring the family.
Yes, the songs are by Cyndi Lauper. And the book is by Harvey Fierstein of Torch Song Trilogy, La Cage aux Folles. Of course, he also was in Hairspray. I'm going to say, yes, you will invest.
After what I said at the top of the show? No, absolutely not. Actually, the film is family friendly. I didn't mean to imply that drag queens were not family friendly. Please don't let RuPaul get angry at me. But I did not like the movie very much. They've released a song by Cyndi Lauper for the show. It was dreadful. And I love Cyndi Lauper. It wasn't a good pop song, and it certainly wasn't a good Broadway song. And it's just a bad idea from a mild little movie. It just sounds like a train wreck to me, and I wouldn't go within a mile of it.
Motown also opens in April. Of course, now I sound like I'm a radio DJ. It's a jukebox musical about the rise of Motown Records and the record label, featuring one of the most valuable pop catalogs in history. The book is by Berry Gordy of Motown. I'm going to say Michael Giltz is plunking down money to invest in Motown.
I am not.
What?
And this is a close call, and it hurts me because, boy, if there's a jukebox musical you want to make or back, it's one with the music of Motown. That is a primo catalog. But Berry Gordy is writing the book. Berry Gordy is not a writer, and he's certainly not a Broadway musical writer. He doesn't know anything about writing a musical, which means A, it's going to be heavily sanitized and boring about the rise of Motown, and B, probably not that competent. So despite the fact that it's got a, you know, solid gold catalog of songs, and I may live to regret it, but my feeling is with his control over it, and he's a notorious penny pincher as well, so he's backing this baby, which means it's going to be done on the cheap. And he's going to be in charge of it. It's going to be sanitized and boring. And he's writing the book. That tells me I don't want anything to do with this.
Well, he's getting credited with writing the book. We'll see. Well,
he's involved, baby. It's his money, his show. Trust me.
All right.
Nobody is writing the entire musical of a show and not getting credit for it. It's not quite like a biography where you have ghostwriters. That doesn't happen on Broadway.
Well, this next one is by one of my favorite writers. It is I'll Eat You Last. It'll be opening in April. Bette Midler is starring in a one-woman show about a Hollywood super agent, Sue Mengers, and is written by John Logan, who is the Tony winner for Red, which really wasn't a one-man show, but it had two actors in it only.
A two-hander.
A two-hander, yeah. He's the screenwriter for the new James Bond, Skyfall, The Aviator, Hugo, many, many other films, Any Given Sunday. I mean, he goes way back. It's going to be directed by Joe Mantello, a Tony winner and the director of Wicked, I'm going to say that you won't invest, and here's why. Because Bette Midler isn't going to do this for 2 years. And trying to make your money back on something like this, even with John Logan, even with Joe Mantello, you have that star, and the second she's gone, it's going to be hard to recast.
And it probably won't even be recast. It's probably something that will close. You'll make your money back. Everybody, it's a safe investment as far as will you lose your money? Probably not. It'll probably be sold out from the beginning to the end of its run. However, the upside is very limited.
So would you invest?
No, I wouldn't, because there's no big upside. Unless Bette Midler wants to tour the world for 4 years, unless you think the show is such a broad commercial property that it's going to work regionally and make its money back with, you know, local productions down the road. It doesn't sound like it. It's just a not a vanity project, but it's just a project with very little upside. There's nowhere for it to go. So once she leaves, like you say, unless she wants to tour the world for 3 years, you know, you're not going to lose your money, but you're not going to make, at best, you're going to make a very modest amount. So why bother?
Okay, so then the next one I can say you're not going to invest in either. Pippin, the revival of the Stephen Schwartz musical, and Schwartz penned Wicked and Godspell. It features Cirque du Soleil, circus acts and illusions. The original won Ben Vereen a Tony Award for Best Actor, and I'm going to say you're not going to invest in this.
Ooh, why is that?
Just because Pippin isn't a really good musical to begin with. It's great for high schools, but you're investing in this production, and I don't necessarily know that this production is going to make any money.
It got some pretty interesting reviews. It's already been revived on the road, and this is the production that is transferring to Broadway, but I am a little suspicious of it. I'm sort of on the fence, because Stephen Schwartz, even though his shows aren't very good, they make a lot of money. Wicked is not exactly a good musical, and that's one of the biggest blockbusters of all time. And every teenage girl, if there is any, who actually listens to the show just got angry with me. But yes, I'm wary of this. There could be a lot of upside. However, if I was going to pick five shows and invest $100,000 each, I might go with this, but I'm very much on the fence, and I'd probably say no.
Well, what about The Trip to Bountiful? It opens in April, stars Cicely Tyson, Cuba Gooding Jr., of course, Academy Award winner Cuba Gooding Jr., who isn't a big Broadway star, so I don't know what he's doing there. Vanessa Williams. It's based on a play by Horton Foote and directed by Michael Wilson, who did Gore Vidal's The Best Man, Horton Foote's Dividing the Estate, and The Orphan's Home Cycle. It's about an elderly woman who wants to visit her hometown in Texas one last time. She boards a bus and reminisces about her life with fellow passengers. It's going to be played by Lillian...
Well, no, the role that Cicely Tyson is tackling has been played in the past by Lillian Gish on television and Geraldine Page, who won the Oscar for it in the film version of The Trip to Bountiful.
Well, I'm going to say you aren't investing in this at all.
That's right. I'm actually looking forward to this very much. The director, Michael Wilson, has done a great job with Horton Foote. The Orphan's Home Cycle was one of the great productions of 2 years ago. I was surprised that didn't transfer to Broadway. I felt like that really could have. I think this is commercial, and I think it'll do well, but I'm not sure who you're going to cast in it after Cicely Tyson.
Okay.
You know, she's going to do it for 6 months or a year. Again, it's a play, and so the upside is very small. It's a sad fact, but on Broadway, it's very hard to make a lot of money off a play. And this revival of it, I don't think it's going to suddenly turn into a huge property for, you know, regional productions or touring. So, unfortunately, I'll have to say no.
Okay, well, I'm going to try and get through the rest of these pretty quickly here. Jekyll and Hyde, I'm going to go with no. It opens in May. Revival stars Constantine Morales.
Constantine Maroulis of American Idol and Rock of Ages.
Okay. Frank Wildhorn musical. I don't see you investing in this at all.
It's Frank Wildhorn's biggest musical of all time. Constantine Maroulis is a draw on Broadway, but no, I wouldn't invest in it. It's been on the road. It hasn't been well reviewed, and I'm not interested.
Pump Boys and Dinettes opens in April. It's a revival of a Broadway musical from 1982. It stars Bo Bice of American Idol, and it's going to be directed by John Doyle. I'm going to go with no.
And the answer is yes.
What?
Okay. This is a charmer from the early 80s, and it's a patented perfect show for John Doyle, who's sort of known for musicals where the actors on stage play their own instruments. And that's what they did for this charming little musical back in the early 80s. It was created by Deborah Monk, and the other actors are in the cast. And I think there's a lot of fond feeling for the show, even though it hasn't been around for 30 years. I wish it was off Broadway and they can make money that way, because it's a small show, but I think they'll be in a small house. And I really like the prospects for this, especially on the road and down the road. I think they're really going to bring this puppy back to life. And it's always been a very popular show in community theater and elsewhere, but I feel like this is really due for a revival.
Big Fish. It's going to open in October. It's based on the John August novel, and the Tim Burton film. It stars Norbert Leo Butz, Kate Baldwin, and Bobby Steggert. Songs are by Andrew Lippa of the Addams Family, and the director and choreographer is Susan Stroman. I'm going to go with, and I guess the name of the game is Invest and Don't Invest. I've been saying, no, you're not going to invest. I'm going to say don't invest.
And I won't invest. You're right. I just don't think this is a very interesting idea for a musical. I'm not sold on Andrew Lippa. It's a great cast, but I don't want to go near it.
Now, Diner, the musical, opens in the fall. It is, you know, based on the film, which was directed by Barry Levinson. The songs are going to be by Sheryl Crow, and I guess the book is also by Barry Levinson. It's going to be directed by Kathleen Marshall. I'm going to say invest.
I'd love to hear the songs. If I have to do this sight unseen, I don't invest because Sheryl Crow has never written a musical. Barry Levinson has never written a score. Barry Levinson has never written a musical. This is not their world. Anybody can have beginner's luck. They're all both talented people. But you go see Diner, you want to hear the classic 50s tunes a la American Graffiti. But in this case, they've gone with all originals, which may make sense and maybe they'll be great. But without hearing them first, no thank you. Okay. I don't want to be there for people's, you know, first try.
Okay, the next one is Prince of Broadway. Comes out in the fall of 2013. It'll be put on. The director, Hal Prince's greatest hits, a la, I guess, Fosse would be a good example. It's going to be directed by Susan Stroman. It's going to star Linda Lavin, Sierra, I can't pronounce that, Bogus. Shuler Hensley, Emily Skinner, etc. Prince directed Cabaret, Company, Follies, Sweeney Todd, Evita, Kiss of the Spider-Woman, Showboat from 1994, and The Phantom of the Opera. I'm going to go with invest.
You're right, and I think the reason is obvious. It's sort of a foolproof greatest hit show, and it's going to be successful.
Okay, then what about Flashdance? This is the, you know, welder by day, flash dancer by night story. Yet, and yes, it includes the songs Maniac, Manhunt.
She's a maniac.
Oh, my God. Gloria, and, well, what about What a Feeling? What, that one you're not going to sing? Okay, well, played in London, it's touring the U.S., and then going on to Broadway. I'm going to say invest.
Oh, God, no. it was a bomb in London. Got terrible reviews. It's a horrible idea. And I did just hear Gloria on the radio when I was at the grocery store this morning. But no, do not invest in Flashdance.
Well, we'll have to actually go back and see if, here's what I got. Cinderella, Matilda, Pump Boys and Dinettes, and Prince of Broadway. Whether these were successful or not, and to see whether Michael lost his imaginary money.
And but, see if I missed out on any big opportunities.
Yes, because that would be a big deal.
So we'll see you in January for that, but it's time for Big Deal, Big Whoop.
That's right. That's our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, how could it not? It should have been the first story of the show. J.J. Abrams didn't win the chance to direct the next Star Wars movie. He said he wasn't interested and then had producer Kathleen Kennedy, the head of Lucasfilm, come to Abrams and woo him, saying, please, please, please bring your Star Trek magic to Star Wars. Abrams said, well, yes, all while juggling the May releases of his second Trekkie movie, another Mission Impossible film in the works, and scoring two TV pilots for the fall of 2013. Peter Jackson better watch his back, or Abrams might try and steal away the Lord of the Rings franchise while he's at it. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a very big deal. Is this even allowed? Are you allowed to do both Star Trek and Star Wars? That's almost, it boggles the mind.
I agree.
It's kind of like if Christian Bale finished up with Batman and then became Superman or James Bond. Like, you only get one franchise.
You know, what I loved was all the tweets. Damon Lindelof, who worked with J.J. Abrams on Lost, his tweet was, hey, everybody, what did I miss?
That's a good one. The best news about this, however, is that there was a notice in the thing about this that Abrams had not committed to the May 2015 release date. It didn't say that he was junking that release date, but it did leave open the possibility that, hey, if they need to do more work on the script and stuff, that he was not going to be locked into that. He has a lot of stuff on his plate, and it should take a while to do Star Wars right, so you shouldn't have a release date locked in this early. So let's get the script right first, and I think that's a very good sign for the quality of the film.
That's true. I do like what one young Il Kim wrote on Twitter. He writes, Comic-Con announced today it will be moving from San Diego to J.J. Abrams' backyard. Which, yeah, I mean, so is it a big deal or a big whoop?
That's a very big deal.
Okay, well, what about Girls?
Oh, Girls, all I really want is Girls. It's a musical episode of Showbiz Sandbox.
That's true. HBO announced that its award-winning hip series Girls will be back for a third season, shocking absolutely no one. That's the good news. The bad news is that season two, the opener for season two, was down or about equal or 42% better than the season one debut. Did you follow that?
Nope.
Because I have no idea what I just said. It depends. How you slice the numbers, that's really what it all amounts to. Season 2 opened with 866,000 viewers, down modestly from the 872,000 viewers of the series debut. On the other hand, the Season 1 finale reached a peak of 1 million viewers. Plus, the show snagged major Golden Globes and other awards, so with all that buzz, you'd hope that the show would grow, not decline, just like The Walking Dead, while you'd hope it would grow like The Walking Dead and Mad Men. And, you know, other recent hits that kind of won all of these awards and got all of these accolades and press. On the other hand, the season two opener reached 1.6 million viewers with three airings that first night, 42% more viewers than the season one opener. Toss in HBO On Demand and HBO Go, maybe the show is a hit after all, or at least still growing the way you would expect. So is the weak, or possibly strong, debut of the second season of Girls a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal because it shows the changing viewing patterns, especially for the young people who might be the biggest fans of this show. It's probably not 15, 60-year-olds who are glued to their sets for the show. It's young people especially, and I think they consume television in a different way, and that's why the new season opener, you know, was what it was. Well, it wasn't that those first numbers, they don't sit down at 9 o'clock to watch a new show. They catch it on Rewind, they catch the rerun, they DVR it, they catch it a week later on streaming. That's just how they consume television. So I think the show is growing as a hit, and these numbers, strangely enough, indicate how and why that's happening.
Well, we have a story a little later on about DVRs, but let's move on to Netflix because they had a great week. Revenue was up almost $1 billion, and the company showed a quarterly profit of $8 million rather than a modest loss. The company said it added 2 million subscribers in North America for a total of 27 million subscribers there and 33 million worldwide. The stock leaped up wildly as if the heavens had realigned, and it is now at $132 per share as of, our show taping. That's much better than the, say, low of $50 it hit during the turbulence after the company announced it was splitting DVD and streaming services, but nowhere near the crazy peak of, say, $300 it hit at one point. That was a couple years ago. Coming soon, its first miniseries, House of Cards, which will be available in one fell swoop on February, all 13 episodes. You can watch it once. Just wait for the stories of internet systems overloading and people struggling to access the titles as demand surges, or, if all goes smoothly, for compliments on the company's robust system. Is this stock news, the stock news of Netflix here surging big news, big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal in a certain sense. I mean, it's silly how investors are reacting to this stuff. They'll probably react widely to how House of Cards does its first weekend, which is just no way to invest long term. You should not react like a panicked animal after every little event. A movie opens slightly larger or smaller and people sell a stock of a studio. That's just dumb thinking. But I thought the overreaction to their problems was an overreaction. So I think they should have recovered. And they're doing that now. And it makes sense. And I'm glad to see it.
Now, I bravely defended the money earned by the head of Disney last week, Robert Iger. I said, hey, if the stock surges 75%, why shouldn't the CEO make tens of millions of dollars? Or, as I said exactly, 0.004% of it.
I'm taking back your Karl Marx book.
Okay, not every CEO, I don't even know what that has to do with this, but not every CEO is so successful or so lucky. Viacom CEO Philip Doman, took a beating when he was forced to take a 22% pay cut.
Receiving
only $33 million for his work this year. That's way down from the $43 million he made last year. Similarly, Chairman Sumner Redstone only pulled in $20 million and COO Tom Dooley only made $26 million. In other words, the top three people at Viacom took pay cuts and only received a total of $80 million. Why? You might be asking, why are these people taking such big pay cuts? Well, I think we've talked about it here. You know, MTV and Nickelodeon are down, and Paramount is moribund, except for Star Trek. I mean, Paramount, I don't think they released a film this holiday season. I could be wrong about that. But they're not releasing movies. Operating profit was flat, but the widely held Class B stock has gone up 38% this year. Viacom stock has jumped more than 10% in the past 3 months. Still, the big guys took a hit, getting about $23 million less this year than last, when their total compensation topped $100 million. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop because this is business as usual for Wall Street. But if I was an investor in the stock, I'd feel a little silly. I'd feel like a chump, to be specific.
Well, I'm glad it didn't go up. I mean, certainly we've talked plenty of times here about the troubles that MTV, Nickelodeon, and Paramount were having. So if this stock went up, I'd be a little disappointed.
Well, it's gone up 10% in the past 3 months.
I'm sorry, if their compensation went up. I apologize.
Ah, okay. Yes, they only made $80 million.
Yes. Well, now, this next story is about my favorite store in the entire world.
This is cool.
Amoeba. Now, this is a store that is in Berkeley. It's a used record store and a record store. And they have a branch here in Hollywood now. It was, I think it like beat out the weather as the most popular thing in Southern California. Amoeba may be the last record store in the world, in fact. It has gone digital now in a huge way, a big way. The company has had an online presence for a while now, but they've just expanded their digital offerings in dramatic fashion with all sorts of offerings, including Vinyl Vault. This curated section includes digitized versions of rare and out-of-print obscurities that Amoeba itself spent the time and money to remaster and digitize themselves. So that's right. Think about that. They've taken albums out of their own private collections, i.e. their store, from public domain or defunct labels, or artists so obscure no one knows who they are, and spends the time and money to remaster the music and create digital versions for sale. That's what they've done. They've remastered this stuff that nobody else would have touched. Where appropriate, proceeds will be kept in escrow, so unknown artists who pop up out of the woodwork will be paid. The new digital endeavor has cost $11 million so far, and Amoeba will expand to major label offerings soon. Big deal or big what, Michael? Or can we move on since it's a big deal?
It's a big deal. It's fascinating. It's a lot of money for this record store chain because they're not that big. And they said essentially all their profits from the last few years have gone into this endeavor. And it's kind of, they're like, it's essentially launching a record label and it's focused solely on obscure, you know, 78s, early stuff, weird out of print stuff, 70s country albums that nobody's ever heard of. It's kind of amazing that they've gone to all this effort to create this original content, which essentially won't be available anywhere else. And they think that'll bring people to their website and help them synergize between their physical stores and their online store and keep them in business for years to come. It's a big gamble and it's fascinating.
Now, despite hints and teases and leaks from both the Rolling Stones and possibly even Coachella, that iconic rock band, the Rolling Stones, will not be playing Coachella this year. Can you hear the disappointment in my voice?
I can.
The official lineup was released, and Mick, Keith, and the gang are officially not at the party. Among the acts that will be playing Coachella, headliners Red Hot Chili Peppers, Blur, The Stone Roses, Phoenix, Yeah Yeah Yeahs, Nick Cave, who will play with the Bad Seeds in one other group, New Order, The XX, The Lumineers, Of Monsters and Men, Violent Femmes, Johnny Marr, Vampire Weekend, Grimes, Grizzly Bear, Beach House, Wu-Tang Clan, Jurassic 5, Skrillex, Woo! And many, many more. Ticket prices have risen. They've risen ridiculously, actually. And fans must buy a shuttle pass, adding to the overall cost, adding $50 to the overall cost. Can you tell I'm not really happy about that? So why, despite all the coy leaks, are the Stones not playing? And for fans of the festival, is this lineup a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I'm flummoxed as to why the Stones aren't playing. I have no idea why it would have been on their calendar and then Coachella would have teased it, and then it turns out not to be true. Maybe it fell apart at the last minute. I don't know. That's bizarre. But hey, I don't go. I want to know, Sperling, do you think this is an exciting lineup? Are you excited for this year's festival, or is the price and the coolness of the act starting to, you know, get out of whack?
It's definitely starting to get a little out of whack. I mean, for the Red Hot Chili Peppers, they've played at least twice there. I've seen them twice before there, so I don't need to see them again. Phoenix? You know,
but I mean, a lot of people see bands again and again. You know, every time Springsteen comes to town, I'll go see him.
Right. No, I understand that. Phoenix, not a headliner. I don't know why they, I mean, they're a great band. They've got one good album. They've got several albums behind them. They've got a new album coming out. How are they a headliner?
They're
so
not.
Yeah. So Saturday night, they've done this in the past, Coachella. They put Prince in after tickets went on sale and sold out. Then they announced Prince. So something tells me that on that Saturday night, That might be the day that they slot somebody bigger in, because Phoenix, I can't imagine that they're a headliner.
That's their main show on Saturday night?
Yes.
No, there's got to be somebody coming. That's not possible.
I agree.
Well, I'm sorry it's not that exciting for you yet, but maybe that big new name that's probably waiting in the wings will get you more excited. But do me a favor and go check out Stone Roses, because I'd love to see that band in concert. Never done it before.
Yeah, you know, I was up at Sundance when this was announced, and the response was mixed. I think a lot of people were disappointed that the Rolling Stones weren't playing. Coachella themselves re-released their New Year's Day card, or their New Year's card, with arrows. Their card was of a field, the Empire Polo Field, with what looked like a round rock on it. And they said, no, that's not a round rock. They had arrows pointing to the field that said Empire Polo Field, and pointing to the round rock saying polo ball. So, I mean, I don't know. I look at this and I think $399 for, and that's the cheap tickets, and you have to buy a shuttle pass for some apparent reason.
It's up to $450.
It's like going to be like, yeah, at least $450 per ticket. You have to go for 3 days. You can't just go for 1 day. You're out in the sun. I mean, it's just it all of a sudden it becomes, do we really want to do this? Some of the acts are great. I you know, at least half the acts I would love to see. But do I really want to do it in this fashion? And I think that's something that, hey, just like 3D, you know, people begin to weigh the benefits, the pros and cons for paying a lot of money for something. And I'm beginning to see it's about even.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. So maybe the whole festival thing is coming to an end. I doubt it. But in any case, you know, what I love is that Fox, the network Fox, is now begging viewers to use their DVRs. Because in a bold acknowledgement of reality, Fox is telling all these viewers to, quote unquote, set their DVRs and make sure they don't miss the new Kevin Bacon drama the following. This is the highly touted drama, which is apparently the first primetime show to be touted by its network as one viewer should DVR and catch up with. Since DVR viewing is perceived to kick in at 10 p.m., Fox is actually encouraging viewers to skip its local 10 p.m. newscasts and watch one of its pre-recorded TV shows instead. So, you know, Fox is insisting, hey, this is a rare gesture pegged specifically to getting a new series sampled. We're not trying to drive, and this is a quote now, we're not trying to drive viewers to DVRs. And that's what Fox Chief Operating Officer Joe Early explained. He said, we still want the viewing to happen live. Our new slogan is not going to be, we're Fox, set your DVR. So is the Fox ad campaign urging the DVRing of a show a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. You know, it's just, it freaks out other networks for a minute, but pretty soon they'll all be doing it.
Well, now, speaking of DVRing, not everyone wants to encourage the practice more than necessary. That's why it's war between, say, CBS and the Dish Network. The networks are suing Dish Network, and then network CBS, NBC. I mean, I think they're all suing Dish Network over its AutoHop feature, a new sort of mega DVR that lets you record an entire night of primetime programming sans commercials. Then CBS forced its subsidiary CNET to withdraw the new device, the vaguely naughty-sounding Hopper with Sling, that's the name of it, Hopper with Sling, from a list of the best of CES show, the Consumer Electronics Show. That was a big deal, actually, when that happened, because it was made public, and it probably would have won best of CES, but CNET could not include it. So their journalistic integrity was
compromised.
Well, now CBS has filed a new request to cancel its agreement to be carried by Dish. Their reason? CBS says they specifically indicated they did not want to be part of any new fancy features, since TV rights are ensnared in all sorts of technological change, such as making shows available for streaming on tablets. Dish agreed, but CBS says it's now clear that Dish had already planned to launch AutoHop and intentionally chose not to disclose its plans to the network when they renegotiated retransmission rights. That should invalidate the entire deal, says CBS. And of course, Dish, without one of the major networks, would be seriously damaged goods. So, big deal or big whoop?
I think it's kind of a big deal because it's kind of a good case. They specifically said, hey, you don't have any big changes in the works. We want to know because we don't want to be part of it, you know, as far as how you make shows available. And they said, no, we don't. But they did. They had this AutoHop feature in the works at the time when CBS made this new deal. So, it'll be interesting to see if they're successful in court. And, of course, if they get to back out, you know, and eventually, of course, the idea is even if they can't back out, they'll do it when the contract is up. You know, Dish without a major network is a dead in the water.
Yeah. I mean, it's one thing to not have AMC, which is what Dish, you know, for
right. A while, they had a big fight with them. Yeah.
Yeah. AMC, Sundance, IFC, they didn't have them. They settled for $900 million. And, you know, but that happened earlier this year, or sorry, late last year. But without CBS, forget about it. Well, that brings us to Barnes & Noble, who had to put out a fire fanned by the Wall Street Journal last week, and they had to insist that they are committed to physical bookstores, which are known as bricks and mortar in the old book biz. Yes, the Wall Street Journal quoted a top exec from the company projecting they'd have 450 or so stores in a decade. Yes, that's down from the 689 stores that they currently have. But they've been closing 10 or 15 stores a year for years now, and that future store count is perfectly in line with those predictions. Some recent major closures included another store in Manhattan and a very popular, though obviously not that popular, location at DC's Union Station. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a very big deal. They're saying, sure, we're getting rid of a couple hundred stores, but that means nothing. We're getting rid of 239 stores. Don't look at the man behind the curtain. I mean, that's their optimistic prediction, that they will lose over a third of all their stores in 10 years. And I think that actually is optimistic. So the fact that you have to tell people loudly when you're a bookstore that you want to stay in the bookstore business is not a good sign. This guy is not inaccurate what he said to them. And I think that's the best case scenario. So this is a very big deal.
The biggest awards in children literature have just been announced. The Newbery Award winner is The One and Only Ivan by Catherine Applegate. Great book. I loved it. You're supposed to laugh there.
Have you read it?
It's a children's literature.
No. Well, you might have read it.
No, I haven't.
You have kids? Oh, okay.
It's the story of a gorilla who moves to a zoo and makes a new life for himself. Maybe the joke should have come after that, actually. The Caldecott winner for Best Picture Book is This Is Not My Hat by John Cassin, which shows how a fish suffers after stealing someone else's hat. Great
and
book.
That is,
I
and that is
it.
A good book. I really like that book. I do. I'm serious. It's very clever.
While winning the National Book Award is nice, it's not the guaranteed massive sales booster that winning the Booker Prize in the UK has been. However, if you win a Newbery or Caldecott, a big jump in sales is exactly what you can count on. And why? Because parents are lazy and need to be led by the nose by that big shiny silver and or gold sticker on the cover saying, buy me.
No, that's good promotion, good PR, and they're taking advantage. It's not laziness, it's smart. It's saying, hey, it's got a stamp of quality approval, and you even know that it's a gold or silver sticker, which shows how effective it's been. The National Book Awards needs to do a better job of branding itself, because when they go to the effort of singling out a great book or two, it should benefit the book. That's the whole point of it. So hats off to Newbery and Caldecott.
Well, as the winners are snatched up in stores and online, a new study shows that kids aren't using bookstores and libraries as much as they used to discover new books. Their new favorite source for what to read next? What do you think it is?
Well, the internets.
Yes, that's right. The tubes. Online, naturally, as well as friends and family. Mind you, it isn't just kids reading young adult novels. It's also a lot of adults, with 84% of YA purchasers, as they're called, being 18 and over. A third of buyers are between the ages of 30 and 44, and the vast majority of them are buying the books not for their kids or nieces and nephews, but for themselves. And also to hide the fact that they're also buying the 50 Shades of Grey. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. Congrats to the two books. I haven't read The Story of Ivan, but I have read This Is Not My Hat. If you're looking for a good picture book, snap it up. It's a clever one. But I think this is I think we're looking at the Harry Potter generation coming of age. If you were a kid, like say 12 years old when the first Harry Potter book came out, you're now 27 years old. And I think they're just in – that was such a phenomenon. It's hard to overstate how big a deal it was. And I think the – and when you toss in Twilight and The Hunger Games, I think this entire generation has grown up thinking that these books are books to read. If they're good books, you read them. They don't think of them as kids' books or teenager books. And they're 25 or 30, and they're happy to read them. And I think that's a permanent change in these books and the market for them. And I think it's a good thing. A good book is a good book. I've been reading those books for decades and always found great authors. And it's nice to see.
South Park is shaking things up. Traditionally, the animated series has had 14 episodes a season, 7 early in the year and 7 late in the year. They say there was no particular reason for this, and now they're switching to just 10 episodes, all airing in one continuous batch starting in December. This might free up the creators, Trey Parker and Matt Stone, for other projects more easily, such as, say, a feature film version of The Book of Mormon or another Broadway musical, maybe The Book of, I don't know. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. I kind of always hated how the show was split up into 7 episodes and you got to wait 6 months to see the other 7. It's sort of, it's the trend throughout all of television. You know, you don't have a big break between a season. You know, if you have 10 episodes in the fall and another 10 in the spring, it doesn't work. People want to watch a show from beginning to end. And I think putting it together in one batch and having 10 instead of 14, I think it'll be more concentrated. They'll have more chances to do multi-arc episodes. And I think the quality will improve because they're doing 10 instead of 14. And I hope they do another Broadway musical.
By the way, this just in, it looks like Jeff Robinoff over at Warner Brothers is happy and proud of Kevin Tsusahara. I'm serious.
Yeah, I'm sure. Oh, I couldn't be prouder for him.
Well, so. I think that's the right statement to make, frankly.
Well, of course. What else are you going to say? He's your boss.
Yeah, he's the new president for Pizza. Well, the new CEO, but yeah. Well, that kind of wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, speaking of Inside Baseball. And Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And
this week, your cable bill is going up.
It's going up astronomically, at least if you live in Los Angeles. The new owners of the Dodgers baseball team and they're leaving. They're leaving Fox Sports, that is, and they're headed over to Time Warner Cable in the LA market for a cool, you know, $7 to $8 billion over 25 years, and ownership rights to their own channel dubbed Sportsnet LA. God, what a bad name.
It sounds like basketball.
Yeah, they plan to create a financial shell game to limit how much money of the $7 billion rights deal they have to share with other baseball teams, because, of course, there's that whole that
revenue sharing program.
Yeah, and there's 29 teams, and they're like, hey, we ain't sharing. Now, how will they and Time Warner make this pay off? How do you think they're going to do that? They're going
to
do
customers
that
to make us pay more money
by charging between $3 and $5 per customer to carry the channel. And that makes LA the sport's craziest market in the country, with 6 dedicated sports channels to various teams and different leagues. And if you're wondering why your cable bill is so high, here is one big reason. All of these massive sports rights and essential monopoly are, they're just essential monopolies, really. $350 million a year. Does that mean their tickets at the stadium will be pretty much the lowest in the league over at Dodger Stadium? Yeah, I doubt it. And so I look at this and I say, Fox Sports, Fox, you know, Prime Ticket, which is where the Dodgers play now and will play in 2013. We pay, as a cable subscriber, to Time Warner, which, by the way, there is no other choice. You have to have Time Warner if you live in Southern California, or you can have AT&T if you're lucky.
Or Dish.
Or Dish, yes. Dish, or, but that's not cable. So, again, you have to deal with Time Warner if you want cable internet. Unless you live in a Verizon, Fios, or AT&T area, U-verse area, we pay $4 a month for Prime Ticket, okay? Prime Ticket is not going to reduce in cost. It's not as if Fox is going to turn to Time Warner and say, hey, thanks for beating us out for the Dodgers and that $7 billion deal. I guess you can only pay us $2 per...
And for example, in New York, when MSG lost the Yankees, and the Yankees formed their own channel, which is now called the Yes Network, MSG lost the Yankees, but they still had the Knicks, and in fact, it didn't go down a penny.
That's
the money
right.
They got for that channel stayed exactly the same.
$3 per month, I think. And it's the same. It's going to be the same for Prime Ticket. And now, instead of just paying the $3 or $4 per month for Prime Ticket, here comes Time Warner. They're going to up the bill by another $3 to $5 because they're going to charge for their Sportsnet LA. Sports has gotten out of control, and I think it is time for somebody, I don't know who it is, to come in and say, all right, we've got to break this bundle.
Well, it could be the straw that breaks the camel back, but is it a smart move financially for the people? I think it works out to about $300 million a year over 25 years. The terms are changing hour to hour as we get more details. It was 20 years. Now we think it's a 25-year deal. It's $7 to $8 billion. Well, that's a big difference. Is it $7 billion or $8 billion? But let's say that it's $300 million a year for the rights to this team for the next 25 years to show the Dodgers on this channel. Well, if you think about that, that's 162 games of the regular season that they will be able to show on this channel. That's at least 4 hours of programming per game, because games are at least 3 hours long and there's always pregame and postgame. So at a very minimum, you're getting 4 hours of programming for each game. That means you're getting 648 hours of programming for $300 million. That is about $2 million. That's $500,000 an hour. For programming, for a very valuable program that brings in a big audience. If you're a network, you're going to be paying $1 to $2 million for a sitcom and $2 to $3 or $4 million for a drama. So $500,000 for an hour of programming that you know is probably a very good bet in ratings wise, that's actually a pretty good deal. So it's a lot of money, but when you break it down by the hour, $500,000 is not that much money. So it's financially, it could work out. Time Warner gets to keep the money for all the ads that it sells for the channel. And they get the programming, and the channel should be a hit. However, like you say, you've got six different channels in LA, which is crazy. Everybody wants their own channel because they want to make as much money as possible. But you end up with like 10, 12 channels for every team. You know, everybody's got their own channel. So the hockey team has a channel. The basketball team has a channel. Any one of these channels would be more valuable if they owned more than one team. When MSG had the Yankees and the Knicks, that was great synergy in a market. But more and more, you're seeing it's got to be a new channel for every athletic program. And that just gets to be too much, especially when each one of them wants to charge $3, $4, or $5 for every customer on your cable subscriber plan.
Well, let me ask you this. How much do you think an ad spot costs during a Dodgers game? Is it $30,000? Probably not. It's probably more like $5,000 to $10,000.
Oh, I don't know why you would say that. It gets millions of viewers. Gets as good viewers. It's a top 30 ranked show if it was on a prime
Actually,
time
it gets 106,000 viewers.
No, it does not.
Yes, it
no,
does.
It does not. That's ridiculous.
Yes, that was
the
average.
The lowest ranked team in baseball then.
It was the average viewership of Prime Ticket.
Where's your... No. What's... No.
Okay. Here we go in a story titled from the LA Times, Time Warner Cable's Deal with Dodgers Guarantees Sub Fees. And this was from last week, January 24th, written by Joe Flint. He says that's a pretty steep ask for a team whose games last season were watched on average by 106,000 households. So maybe not people, but 106,000 households. The Lakers typically more than double that figure, and the channel its games are carried on, Time Warner Cable Sportsnet, costs between $3.50 and $3.95 a subscriber per month. So
I question that household rating. That seems extremely low. All I know is that regional sports ratings for baseball teams in the local markets are very strong, that they're doing better than the postseason games are doing, that they've been holding steady for a number of years. They're very valuable. Plus, you're reaching men that are hard to reach with normal television advertising. So ads on sports, live sports programming are at a premium.
Well, you know, think about it this way.
It's a regional
though.
Channel, not a national, so it's not the same as a network, but it's still good money.
But think about it this way. You don't have to make $500,000 per hour in advertising to break even because you have the sub fees. So you have that $3 per subscriber per month plus your advertising. That's how they're making their money. But let me ask you, do you think
Time Warner keeps the money for the ads? Don't forget, they're paying them $8 billion, but the Dodgers get $300 million a year, period.
Right.
Time Warner gets to keep the ads.
But I'm talking about if you're Time Warner buying this.
Oh, right. They charge their own customers. That's right.
Right. So,
but does this make any sense? Isn't Time Warner the company that was bitching about how much sports rights were costing?
As a matter of fact, funny you should mention that, they absolutely were. They said, and this was the Time Warner Cable chief executive, Glenn Britt, he told the Wall Street Journal a year ago, what was a minor problem is turning into an astronomical problem. The ultimate solution is to get that programming on some sort of smaller packaging scheme. Okay.
Or to buy it ourselves.
I welcome that opportunity because let me ask you something. All these people that are out there screaming and ranting and raving about the free market, and how everything should be the free market and there should be no subsidies and the government shouldn't come in with the $800 billion subsidy package that was given out in 2008.
You mean stimulus bill?
Thank you, stimulus pack. Let me ask you this. If we weren't forced to buy these channels, these sports channels, do you think the Dodgers would have or Time Warner would have gone in and paid $7 to $8 billion for this programming?
Well, I do, because there aren't many cable companies that would be in business if they didn't offer sports. You might say, oh, I don't care, but a lot of people do, and they're simply not going to go with Dish if Dish doesn't have CBS. They're not going to go with Dish if they don't have the Yankee games. If you can't get the Yankee games, you're not going to subscribe to them.
Right, but you could get them through Fox. They could have let Fox go and take them and come back to Time Warner.
But you're saying, are they worth this much money?
And, right.
You know, you need this programming on your cable system if you're going to reach subscribers. A lot of people will complain about it, but then they care about AMC. Somebody else cares about PBS. So everybody's got their own thing that they think is their must-have. But you break it all down, cable tends, you know, its prices are too high. But people like that big bundle of programming because everybody has some channels that they are absolutely insistent on getting. Well, guess what? That's how we're all paying for each other. You may not care about sports, but you care about AMC. It all works out.
Well, it doesn't work out because I'm paying 25 cents for AMC or a dollar for AMC, and I'm paying $4 for something I don't watch.
Well, it all works out in the end. AMC is raising its rates, believe me. You know, when they can renegotiate, they're certainly getting higher rates than they ever had before.
Well, that's true. They did that.
I don't mean that the money's not too much. I don't mean that Time Warner isn't being hypocritical. I don't mean that I'm happy about it because I'm not. And frankly, they really should think about their ticket prices in the stadium because they're making $300 million a year on just the TV rights. That means even if they have $180 million payroll, they still got $120 million for all their expenses before they sold a single ticket, a single cap, a single shirt, a single hot dog. Well, you know what? They need to realize that their stadium is window dressing for the TV, and they need to make sure that stadium is full by having low-cost tickets so fans can go to a lot of games.
Which I can tell you right now, the Dodgers ticket prices have gone up over the past 5 years. So
yep,
we'll see if they continue to go up. But that's what a lot of people are talking about in our industry, the entertainment industry. And we'd love to know what you think. We want to hear from our listeners. And in fact, we have heard from our listeners. They emailed us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. We have an email from Phil Simon. And Michael, do you want to take it?
Sure. It says, "Hi, guys. We are regular listeners to your podcast and have a technical question, if you don't mind. I produce a comedy podcast here in Melbourne, Australia, called Santo Sam and Ed, which looks back at the week's news and sports. Quite often, one of our presenters is in another state or country, and we haven't yet nailed the sound quality. We've used Skype, FaceTime, etc. When you guys record from separate locations, the sound quality is great. Can you please tell me what software, hardware you use? Thanks heaps, Phil Simon. P.S. By the way, Sting is an idiot."
And if you're wondering what that Sting is an idiot...
listen to last week's show.
That's right. It is last week's show. And first of all, hello to everybody in Melbourne, Australia. And secondly, Phil, well, I guess long and short of it is we use... I record everything on Macs, so Apple computers. I use an iMac to record most of the time when I'm not traveling. And I know, Michael, you're on a Mac, right?
I am on a Mac, and I use a Blue microphone, which is a fairly expensive microphone. It looks like something you'd have in a radio station. I bought that online on Amazon.com, and I'm really happy with the sound quality of that.
And I use a AKG. That's the name of the microphone. I had to go and look at it. AKG Perception 220 microphone, although I've been thinking maybe of changing to a Heil PR40, which is kind of a more standard broadcast mic. It's on a broadcast arm with a pop filter. All of this now, and I call Michael when we do this. Michael is always in New York. Well, not always in New York, but we're always apart when we record.
Yeah, most of the time. And you use Skype, and we have guests. We put them on Skype. So what do you think you're doing that perhaps they're not?
Well, I do a couple things. One, I use two computers when we have guests. So one is the guest computer, and one is the computer that we're recording, and your voice is on, Michael. Two different Skype accounts as well. So one might be, you know, our Showbiz Sandbox account. One might be my personal account. And so there's two different Skype accounts, two different channels of audio going into an Alesis mixer. It's one of the cheaper Alesis mixers. It probably could be a little better. All of that then gets sent via USB into GarageBand. And I use GarageBand just because it's easy and I know it. And I could use SoundBooth or any one of the other products out there, Odyssey, which is free. So maybe it's going through the mixer, getting some preamp. I don't really use preamp, but then I actually do tweak the audio and try and sweeten it up and make it sound good when we edit, when we go into post-production. But I don't really do too much. It's pretty much, I always thought the audio was decent, but not great, specifically because I never was able to soundproof the office that I record in.
Yeah, and you've got kids running in and out all day long.
That's true. That's true too. But
well,
I mean,
Santos. But you know, hopefully, some of those tips will help them. Is there any other suggestions you can have? Making sure, of course, that you have a lot of memory and a great internet connection, of course.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that I would say is when you're using Skype, I always try to do it with a wired connection. That really does help, an Ethernet connection rather than via Wi-Fi. And I try to make sure that there aren't other things on the network sucking up bandwidth, because that does hurt in some cases. I would also say that the microphone, start with a good microphone. That's really, really important.
That makes all the difference in the world. Absolutely.
And yeah.
And wear headphones while you do the show, that they probably do. Santo Sam and Ed, though, you can find them on Facebook. I believe they're on iTunes as well, where you can download their podcast. They've been on television, it looks like, in Australia. They had a very popular show called Santo Sam and Ed's Cup Fever, which I think comes around every time that World Cup is in action. And so that's kind of fun. We'll have to check them out.
Yeah, you know, both Michael and I have been told that we have the voice for radio.
The face for radio.
And the face for radio as well. you know, you can download us on iTunes. In fact, you can download us on the Zune Marketplace or Stitcher or Downcast. Anywhere they give out podcasts for free, you can find us because we don't cost a dime. In fact, again, you can email us dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address. You can even call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, where our handle is showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, where we can be found under the username showbizsandbox. That's where our page is. Links to all of the stories we talked about on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find all those ways to follow us and to subscribe to us and to like us, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. They are not, however, playing Coachella. Michael has a website. It is
Broadway Investors, a.k.a. there'soneborneveryminute.com.
Well, you know, if you can't find some of Michael's work, some of his writing for, say, the Huffington Post, the Daily News, the New York Post, if you can't find it there, try michaelgiltz.com. That's a good place. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
I think they're probably glad in Australia that we didn't say goodbye, mate.
So, especially with that frog in my voice.
Oh, I thought you were just happy to see me.
And I tell bad jokes, yikes.